My interest in Harlem is personal, political, and professional. As a child, my grandmother, who lived on what was then Lenox Avenue, frequently took me to her church to hear Adam Clayton Powell. As a young person hanging out in Small's Restaurant, I met and talked with Malcolm X the evening before he was assassinated. As an adult, I lived in Harlem for 20 years, and my formal research in Harlem has, as Professor Marable pointed out, spanned more than two decades. As you know, Harlem is a historic black community that has often been a focus of black activism against the racist state. Major protest movements and charismatic leaders as diverse as Marcus Garvey, Communist City Council member Benjamin Davis, and Malcolm X have all found a base there. When I began my formal research in this particular project in 1994, Harlem had entered a period of significant decline. Job losses were reflected in an official unemployment rate twice that of New York City. Simultaneous neglect by city and state governments, as reflected in cutbacks in services, as well as increased investment in the private sector, particularly in high-end housing, led to a period of deterioration and decline. Between 1970 and 1990, the number of available housing units in Harlem had declined by about 27%. This period of devastation and displacement in Harlem was then followed by a wave of gentrification, and I'm sure you've heard about this from some of your other speakers. These conditions were reflected in health status. Infant mortality rates in Harlem were twice that of New York City as a whole. This reflected national epidemiological studies demonstrating that black women have problematic birth outcomes, in particular higher rates of infant mortality and low birth weight babies, regardless of their socioeconomic position, and that even college-educated African-American women have twice the infant mortality rate of college-educated white women. Now, in this context, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention circulated an RFP, a request for proposal, and the New York Urban League, which was then based in Harlem and was under the leadership of now Deputy Mayor Dennis Walcott, submitted a research proposal to explore the social context of reproductive health in Harlem. In other words, the CDC wanted to know, if race is not biological, then what is it that explains the disparities in health outcomes for African Americans of all socioeconomic classes? Now, this question about racial inequalities in health is particularly important because the domain of health disparities has become an arena for asserting and contesting explanatory paradigms about difference, inequality, health, and illness. Mainstream interpretive frameworks in medicine and health research have traditionally attributed racial disparities in disease to biological or genetic differences on one hand, or cultural and lifestyle differences between racial groups on the other. Notions of race that are based upon a typological approach to human variation, in other words, the various types of humans, with the implication that genetic differences related to race are a major factor in explaining disease disparities, continue to pervade the medical literature. In fact, this approach has gained new life with the renewed attention to genetics that is reflected in the Human Genome Project and the drug industry's new initiative to produce designer drugs for people of different races. Anybody heard of Vidil? Okay, that's a designer drug produced by the drug companies. They hope to make a lot of money for African Americans, said to work better on African Americans. But this is based on a rather old-fashioned approach to race as opposed to ancestry. The cultural or lifestyle paradigms Sometimes barely concealing culture of poverty and deviance notions are equally problematic. Alleged cultural traits, behaviors, or beliefs implicitly or explicitly considered to be associated with racial groups are often seen as constant, unchanging, and independent of social and historical processes. In other words, an essentialized notion of culture is substituted for race with little attention to the structure of constraints within which people make lifestyle choices. Based on an intersectional model, incorporating the oppressive structures of race, class, and gender and the struggle against them, the Harlem Birthright Research Project explored the meaning of inequality in the everyday lives of women in Harlem by investigating the ways in which class, race, and gender interact in specific situations to condition health and to produce elevated rates of illness and health. We used a variety of methodological approaches. Participant observation was the center of the research design. We had teams of ethnographers who spent 2 to 3 months at each of 10 representative neighborhood and workplace sites. So that, for example, we had, I worked with another ethnographer in a public hospital. Two of my graduate students worked behind the counter in a fast food restaurant that shall remain nameless. Other people hung out in neighborhoods. We worked in a clerical office on 125th Street. And we worked with vendors on 125th Street when there were vendors on 125th Street. Is everybody familiar with participant observation? You know, you hang out and you observe and participate. In addition, we had 22 women that we followed over the course of a year or more. We held 11 focus groups and administered an open-ended interview to a sample of randomly selected women in Central Harlem. Now, one of the most important strategies that we used was community participation. In other words, trying to involve the community and collaborate with community residents in doing the research. We began by holding open community meetings at various points during the research process to discuss the study, to answer questions, and to solicit advice. And when we held the first meeting, we got some very hard questions, such as, why are you here? Such as, why is the Centers for Disease Control spending all this money on research when you could spend it on feeding people? Okay, these were very important and relevant questions, which we addressed and discussed with people the project. We formed a community advisory board that met quarterly throughout the project to advise the research team on all aspects of the research and to review findings. In a subsequent research project, the research team incorporated Photo Voice, and this is a participatory action research strategy which was developed by Carolyn Wang at the University of Michigan. And what you do in this kind of research is provide community residents with disposable cameras, and you ask them to take photographs around a certain topic and then to write a text for the photograph that they take. And we did this with respect to welfare reform, and we got some very interesting pictures and texts which were displayed in City Hall for several months. The first task was to define Harlem. How do you define Harlem? Harlem can be defined in any number of different ways. Harlem is a health district. Harlem is a community district. The health district has different boundaries, slightly different boundaries than the community district. We defined Harlem as a symbolic community, and we defined Harlemites as people who work and live in Harlem. So we were interested then in exploring the social conditions that bear on higher rates of illness and death and how community residents struggle against them. These were fully reported in a book, Stress and Resilience, The Social Context of Reproduction in Central Harlem. And I understand you've read, or at least you've been assigned, the first three chapters, which document the stressors connected with economic decline and the displacement of people from neighborhoods. However, we also involved really heroic efforts to address these issues, and that's the resistance and resilience part of the title. I use the term transformative work to recognize that women work outside the home, inside the home, but then also engage in transformative work that I define as efforts to sustain continuity under transformed circumstances and strategies to transform circumstances in order to maintain community continuity. Transformative work involves many domains. For example, households develop flexible strategies for subsistence, including piecing together resources garnered from state subsidies, work in formal, informal, and underground sectors, use of private food pantries and charities, private transfers in the forms of services, information, and resources from relatives and friends. In other words, where there's high unemployment, people develop various strategies to provide subsistence. People created work, and some of you have probably read Robin Kelly, Creating Work from Play. People created work from all kinds of things. They created work from such activities as DJing, flower arrangement, kitchen planning, babysitting, hair care, and vending all manner of goods. Household strategies frequently included education for one or more members of the household, often at a public college facility, such as where I teach. In the research, we found that among community residents, there was a tremendous nostalgia for community and a determination to recreate it. So residents spoke very movingly of a past which was characterized by a sense of community. The interview respondents discussed many of the positive aspects of the environment, such as the variety of cultural and spiritual activities that may serve as protective factors for them and mitigate some of the stressors and strains. Perhaps even more significant was the respondents' view that the cultural, historical, and social advantages of living in a black community outweighed a lot of the problems to which the community was subject. 99% of the survey respondents cited living in a black community as a positive aspect of their environment. And I remember interviewing one particular middle-class couple, and this was before Harlem was as gentrified as it is, and one of them pointed out that she had been living on the Upper West Side in a white area around the time that the Central Park, well, we now call them the Central Park Five. At that time, they were known as the Central Park Joggers. These were five young men who were erroneously arrested for attacking a woman in Central Park. And she said she used to go to work with earphones on to kind of screen out all the remarks of her coworkers. Turns out, of course, these five young men were not guilty of that crime. And so she then moved to Harlem because she said, at least I have a place to come home to where I don't have to listen to that, despite the fact that they won't collect garbage, despite the fact that you can't keep up housing, I don't have to deal with this day-to-day racism. So in attempting to deal with problems around housing and the environment, women utilize both individual and collective strategies to obtain and retain adequate shelter for themselves and their families and to improve their housing and neighborhood conditions. These ranged from individual daily actions to organized struggles for more long-term solutions. One recourse women employed was to take landlords to housing court for neglecting repairs. And almost 40% of the respondents to the survey had been to housing court, and over two-thirds of those had represented themselves against the lawyers of their landlords. Others worked with block associations, tenant organizations, and a wide range of community groups. individually and collectively across social strata, the women we studied were very active participants in efforts to improve the quality of space in Harlem. They did things such as keep calling sanitation to request the removal of garbage and to clean up vacant lots, planting flowers, turning vacant lots into community gardens, or organizing against environmental racism. But all of these interventions that I'm calling transformative work, it's important to remember, require considerable time and energy, and women are both working within the household, taking care of families, and also working outside the household, but then also doing this work in their communities. Family and support networks involving both men and women played an important part in their lives. Deindustrialization and the consequent disproportionately high levels of unemployment, as well as the expansion of the prison industrial complex, largely based on racial discrimination in policing and sentencing and selective enforcement of laws, has resulted in a shortage of men as sons, brothers, fathers, and partners, and an increase in women raising children without support from men. This affects African American women across all social strata, and in Central Harlem at the time of the research, approximately two-thirds of all households with children under 18 were described as headed by women. However, the researchers found that though economic conditions severely strain support systems, people perceive family to be important and were involved in a variety of flexible support systems. Almost all the respondents to the survey, 95%, commented on the importance of family ties, and overall 90% of women reported that family relationships were most important to them. Despite popular perceptions concerning the absence of men, we observed that women related to men in a variety of roles and reported that men in many different types of kin and partner relations were important in their lives, despite the fact that they were not formally married. So the research then revealed the fluid and dynamic nature of family and support networks, the continuing importance of blood-related kin, a wide variety and great flexibility of residential arrangements, and the significance of non-blood kin and the importance of women-centered networks. However, it was the women who were always responsible for recruiting and servicing these support networks. And anthropologists have described this kind of work as kin work. And note that, unlike housework and childcare, kin work is generally unlabeled. Those of you who are putting together dinners, for example, for Thanksgiving, this is kin work. But no one actually counts kin work when you talk about housework, you talk about childcare, etc. But kin work has a purpose. You're putting together support systems because support systems are going to be important, and you have to service those support systems. And while our study participants reported positive experiences with family and support systems, they also reported constraints. Among survey respondents, the higher the level of education, the more frequently family was reported as a major source of stress. And I think this is easily explained by the heterogeneity of African American families. The middle stratum participants were frequently the only member of their family to attain middle class status. So of course everybody was calling on them for everything. And so while the support networks are an important resistance resource, in conditions of inequality, kin work, along with the other transformative strategies women take on, may be simultaneously stressful and protective. In researching resistance resources and transformative strategies, we came into conflict with the Centers for Disease Control. National agencies and institutions, particularly those concerned with health and disease, often have a strong investment in an implicitly pathological model that portrays communities as sick, disorganized, etc. And these people in these agencies may interpret oppositional behaviors as noncompliant, dysfunctional, or pathological. Furthermore, these institutions are frequently unwilling to accept results of a study that point to long-term structural change. Research that emphasizes dysfunctional cultural and individual behaviors produce recommendations for what they call manageable interventions in the lives of their subjects. On the other hand, research that is designed to illuminate structural constraints and the ways in which people resist them often point to the need for large-scale social changes, such as improving access to employment, shelter, education, and health care. And national institutions are generally not prepared to tackle these large-scale social changes. Community residents recognized that there were severe health and social problems, but also had a strong investment in a health as compared to a disease model of the community. The commitment to demonstrate the strengths as well as the weaknesses of the community was evident in a few examples. For example, early in the study, the CDC requested data using traditional categories found in public documents: unemployment, percentage of people below poverty, percentage of people receiving public assistance, number of vacant buildings, etc. So we put together a draft of these statistics, made little charts, made slides, etc. We showed them to the Community Advisory Board. And the Community Advisory Board said, okay, that's fine, but why don't you just reverse the statistics? In other words, why don't you talk about the percentage of people above poverty, the percentage of people who are employed, the percentage of people who are in school? In other words, not change the numbers, but think about the way in which you represent a community by stressing the negative characteristics as opposed to stressing the positive characteristics. So as a result of this discussion, we created additional presentation that didn't change any figures, but counterposed them, and that displayed the percentage of people above the poverty line, the percentage of people not on public assistance, etc. So with the assistance of community residents, we tried to address the way in which what appears as objective statistical presentations emphasize negative characteristics and thereby legitimize stereotypes and unequal power relations. So together, the researchers and the Community Advisory Board began to think about alternative approaches to research that would illuminate the resistance and activism of women in trying to deal with their daily lives. So they talked to us about researching such activities as complaints of police brutality, women who call housing and try to get the housing code requirements enforced, taking legal actions concerning job loss, and resisting the placement of children in special education. In other words, researchers generally don't look at these aspects. They look at the more traditional things that paint the community in a negative way and don't show really what's going on with respect to activism and resistance. For example, it was a member of the Community Advisory Board who suggested that we make Housing Court one of our research sites. That had not occurred to us because Housing Court was not in Harlem. It's in downtown New York. And he said to us, Housing Court is where so many women from Harlem go to actually fight legally to retain their housing. And that was absolutely true. Another example, we put together a brochure on the research methods of the study, and we put this together with the Community Advisory Board. And the Community Advisory Board insisted on the title, Exploring the Strengths of the Community, rather than something like why are there higher rates of infant mortality? And I brought a couple of them for you to look at, which are somewhere over there. And you can maybe look at them after class. Okay, so once we completed the research, it was necessary to develop a framework to address the question of why African American women and men have higher rates of illness and death. We hope to speak not only to an academic or public health audience about health disparities, but also to African American women themselves about their lived experience. We wanted to recognize and name issues that are frequently unlabeled and to bridge the gap between critical medical anthropology, which is what this was, and public health models by demonstrating the ways in which intersections of class, race, and gender hierarchies are actually embodied, are expressed in the bodies of women. In order to incorporate and conceptualize the effects of these hierarchies on health, as well as to integrate a history of resistance and allow for the exploration of agency, we developed a framework we termed the Sojourner Syndrome. The Sojourner Syndrome is designed to express the intersecting and overlapping gendered notions of responsibility found in the symbol of Sojourner Truth. In a speech that underscores the memorable phrase, "Ain't I a woman?", Sojourner Truth dramatically depicts the various responsibilities of African American women carried out in circumstances characterized by racial and gender oppression. She says, quote, "That man over there says that women need to be helped into carriages and lifted over ditches and to have the best place everywhere. Nobody ever helps me into carriages or over mud puddles or gives me any best place, and ain't I a woman? Look at me, look at my arm. I have plowed and planted and gathered into barns, and no man could head me. And ain't I a woman? I could work as hard and eat as much as a man when I could get it and bear the lash as well. And ain't I a woman? I have borne 13 children and seen most of them sold off into slavery, and when I cried out with my mother's grief, none but Jesus heard me, and ain't I a woman?" Sojourner Truth, of course, was born in slavery and was an early abolitionist. Sojourner Truth's account embodies the findings of the research. The assumption of economic, household, and community responsibilities, which are expressed in family headship, working outside the home, and the constant need to address community empowerment, often carried out in circumstances made difficult by discrimination and scarce resources. In addition, the model of Sojourner Truth speaks to the contradiction between the ideal models of gender and the lives of black women. In other words, exclusion from the protections of private patriarchy offered to white women by the concept of womanhood, motherhood, and femininity. We suggested to the Centers for Disease Control that exploration of the consequences of these intersecting responsibilities that exist for African American women across class may give us insight into the way in which class, race, and gender structure constraints and choices, and thereby structure vulnerability to disease. The Sojourner Syndrome expresses the combined effects of race, class, and gender. Elevated risk of disease is also observed for college-educated women because of their simultaneous exposure to both racism and sexism. And so we hope then that this framework helps to clarify the mechanism by which race mediates both gender and class status. The consequences of race and gender, of being a black woman, contribute to the inequality of class status. So we saw this in the vulnerability of middle stratum women in our study, whose employment situation was frequently precarious due to restructuring or downsizing in the public sector. Furthermore, race can dilute the protections of class. Again, middle-class black women may have attained the achievements necessary for middle-class status, but they continue to suffer job and occupational discrimination. They are less likely to have male partners and more likely to become single heads of households. And for middle-class women in the study who moved to a black community to avoid racism, their class advantage was diluted by the structural discrimination and neglect to which the black community was subject. So this framework then also allowed us to consider the interaction of race, class, and gender discrimination on one hand, and agency and resistance on the other. The Sojourner Syndrome, which speaks not only to the structural constraints that have implications for illness, but also to what people do about them, represents a strategy for fostering the reproduction and the continuity of the black community. In other words, the Sojourner Syndrome is a survival strategy which may have both short-term and long-term benefits, but it may also have costs. And among them may be serious health consequences. After completing the research phase of the project, physiologists were able to identify, after we completed the research phase of the project, physiologists employed by the CDC were able to identify the physiological mechanisms by which hormones released during episodes of acute stress and chronic strain can stimulate early labor, which leads to high infant mortality. Furthermore, they found that these alterations during pregnancy also increase vulnerability to maternal infections. Stress can therefore cause the early onset of labor, as well as lowered resistance to infections. In other words, while race may not be biological, racism has biological consequences. The Sojourner Syndrome, then, attempts to capture a paradox that the enduring duality of race lies in the complicated fact that the imposition of race inevitably creates the structural context for producing oppositional sites of resistance, as well as creative spaces for the articulation of subaltern consciousness, culture, and opposition. Race, class, and gender in Harlem thus become potentially spaces for resistance, counter-narrative, and the emergence of liberatory potential. And I'm happy to take your questions and comments. Yes.
And I was wondering if you might be able to sort of give a general impression of maybe some of the dynamic voices that were expressed.
Yes, actually, I probably should have brought slides, but didn't get them together in time. This was a different project, and this project was called the New York State Scholar Practitioner Project. And what we did with this project is employ graduate students, I only teach graduate students, give graduate students fellowships to form a bridge between advocacy and grassroots organizations and research. So they attempted to translate research and make it usable to advocacy and grassroots organizations, and to also do research themselves to make information available. So we gave people cameras, and they took pictures of different things. We asked them, what has welfare reform meant for your community? And one picture was of a chest of drawers and a mattress, which was out on the sidewalk. And the text said, people are being evicted from their homes. And in the past, people used, and this was in the 30s with the unemployed councils, people used to move the things, their furniture back in to their apartments when they were evicted. But I can tell, this text went on to say, by looking in the drawers, which were full, that this is not just sitting out on the sidewalk, people have been evicted. So there were pictures like that. There were also pictures of community gardens and people saying this is the way life should be. It should be pretty. We should be able to have gardens. We should be able to have flowers, etc. So there are a range of pictures with a range of different texts. Yes.
Through your research, how do you feel that the cyclical effect of stressors being connected and related to economic decline or displacement as far as black women and how that are connected to their rates of infant mortality, how do you feel that that cyclical effect will end or play out, I guess, in the future?
Well, I think what has to happen... Are you asking me what's happening in Harlem now being gentrified or what is necessary in the future?
Well,
what's happening now, I would say, for low-income women is probably increased stress because, as you know, Harlem's being gentrified. You know, some aspects of that are good, but many are very problematic because people are no longer able to afford to live there. So after the first study, we went back maybe 5 years later to look for some of the study subjects, and many of them had moved to places like the Bronx or Brooklyn because they could no longer afford to live in Harlem. So for middle-income women, there may be a lower level of stress because as Harlem gentrifies, you get more services in Harlem, such as, you know, collection of garbage, etc. In the long run, what we documented were stressors that were related to unemployment, that were related to working at very difficult jobs, that were related to having to fight for shelter every moment. And in the long run, in order, I think, to deal with those stresses, you're going to have major structural changes that see, for example, shelter as a human right, or see healthcare as a human right, or see the right to a job as a human right. And I think at that point, then it's possible to talk about what disparities in health may be related to ancestry. But until one deals with those issues, I think it's really irrelevant in many ways to talk about racial differences. Yes.
I have a question about the survival strategy that you talked about, the Sojourner Syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to know, do you think that that's, sort of fundamentally at odds with this notion of the endangered black man and, their plight for survival in light of the prison industrial complex, massive rates of incarceration? And this sort of positioning of the black woman against the black man, I guess.
No, I would say it's not at odds with it at all. This study was designed to study black women. Black men were not a part of this study except as they related to black women. The Sojourner Syndrome does not suggest at all that men are not involved in assisting with the survival of the black community. In fact, all of the research we did really documents the participation of men in kinship groups, etc. It is the case, however, that with the prison industrial complex, there's certainly fewer men around that can participate in these networks. But our view was that the Sojourner Complex was named such because we were dealing with women, but this in no way suggests in any sense that men are not involved in these processes as well. Yes.
Socialized to fulfill certain gendered ideals,
just like we play with baby dolls, we're already socialized to be mothers, you know, at such a young age. And so I'm curious, do you believe that that black women at this point in time can be socialized as at a young age to take on this persona of the strong black woman?
I think I hear what you're saying. One of the things that the Centers for Disease Control was concerned with is the fact that black women across class had higher rates of infant mortality, low birth weight babies, and infant mortality than white women. And so the question they asked is, if this occurs across class, and you say, as an anthropologist, there's no such thing as race, then what is it? So what we attempted to do was to really demonstrate what are the issues that affect black women across class. And certainly they affect them in different ways, in different socioeconomic strata. Having documented all of that, the conclusion is not, I think, that black women should not do these things. But I think it's important that women be conscious of what they're doing. And so very often when I've spoken to black women, especially middle stratum black women, it resonates with them because they are not conscious of the fact, for example, that they're doing kin work, that they're holding together networks, that they're doing things on so many different levels because they just do it automatically. I think it's important to be conscious of it and to work in such a way that deals with the causes of ill health as part of the social structure rather than as individual failings. So when people see, well, it's not me, it's really a whole structure of things out there, and this is a common problem among black women, I think the way in which people address that then is very different. Rather than address it individually, you may want to address it collectively.
I think we have
That's it?
End.
Okay.
All right. Thank Dr. Mullings for a great presentation. Thank you.